Good afternoon, Richard Mulcahy is my name, and this is Curiosity Radio on 103.2 Dublin City FM. I had the pleasure of talking with Coleman Nochter last week, who is a psychoanalytical psychotherapist, not physiotherapist. And we only touched on the subject, and I'm delighted to say Coleman is back with us today. Thank you for coming back, Coleman.
Thank you.
And we had been talking about common problems with teenagers, you see, and you're talking about anxiety and things like that. What are the parents doing differently now than 30 or 40 years ago with their children? Has there any impact on?
I think it's very difficult for parents at the moment. In common culture, I think we have less and less time with our children. And I think as a working parent myself, you see these kind of windows of time that you spend with your children, albeit, you know, 30 minutes in the morning while you're rushing to get them out and then collecting them from childminder or creche or whatever it might be, and then getting them ready for bed or homework or whatever it needs to be done. And, you know, that's all done through a haze of tiredness and irritability. And that might be just the parents, you know, in terms of how we see that. I'm always interested in how many times we tell our children to hurry up.
You could put an app for that now, and just to text.
Because I notice it myself. Get into the car seat, sit down, hurry. Everything's done in such a rush that the opportunity for quality time then is perhaps when at the weekends where you have some time, and you don't want to spend that disciplining your children or engaging in sanctions and stuff. So I think the temptation then is to indulge. And I did that when my first child was born. You know, we were spending more time in Smith's, you know, buying toys and things like that. And I was kind of asking myself, what is he learning through this process? Is that, you know, that things come very easy? That, and I noticed in one of the Christmases that, you know, the toys that he was getting, he wasn't valuing. There wasn't a meaning in that. And so I just think it made me, it was a kind of a eureka moment for me to kind of go, that's how most people must try and survive parenthood. So I really made a change to try and think about how to use that time differently. It's not about having time as in quantity, but actually how can I engage in the quality of the windows of time differently. But I think parents have a huge challenge in trying to do that with financial pressures, pressures to work, long commutes, etc. I think it does take its toll on the relationship between children and their parents. And for me, that's the key in terms of a child surviving any adversity or trauma is an approachable and understanding relationship that they have with their parents, that they can go to that. And I think in a world where we're kind of worried about, you know, devices and technology taking over or parenting our children or creating an alternative desire that is damaging the relationships we have with our children, I think it's now where that relationship is actually more important than it ever was before, that we actually spend more time rather than less, or more quality time.
And of course, what's changed significantly has been where mother used to always be at home.
Yeah.
A lot of my friends, yeah, when they were growing up, that's their mother was at home.
Yeah, we spoke last week about my parents. My mum was a nurse, so yeah, she worked full time. But even my mum doing nights, she would get us up for school, get us down to school. Mm. We'd go to school, and we'd be home at 2 or 3 o'clock. She'd be up again. So it didn't feel almost that she worked,
that she was
quite
working,
so much.
Yeah.
But I think the extended community as well, in terms of aunts and cousins and things being around, I spent a lot of time with cousins and people. Whereas when I had my first child, we lived in a kind of isolated, kind of typically apartment duplex situation, didn't know our neighbours, weren't very connected to either of our families. And so it became a kind of a very solo run, rather than it being much more of a community, you know, that village raises a child idea.
Yeah.
But I think our physical neighbourhoods have never been smaller, whereas our virtual neighbourhoods have never been bigger. And I think that's an interesting concept, because children don't tend to, you know, hang around as much. And I know we've worries about teenagers hanging around, but it's some part of their development is having the opportunity to do that. I would think I've said this before, my socialization happened on the 65 bus going in and out to school, because I went to an all boys school, but there was in Tempelow College with girls from Our Lady.
But you had a girls' school across the road from you, didn't you? And very attractive girls, if I remember.
For sure. and it was on that 65 bus from Blessington to Tempelow, which would have been a maybe 40 minute journey that you learned so much about life. Yeah, it was really in that experience. I just wonder whether children or teenagers have that experience now.
But of course, Facebook makes up for that.
But it doesn't.
No, but I mean, it's perceived to make up for that, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I would have seen young people in the last few years, and especially girls who come to their debs and they go, I don't have anyone to ask, are really stressed about that. And you're wondering, because these are quite charismatic, able young people, but it's the opportunity. They may have gone to an all-girls school, they've played camogie and ballet all their lives, all of their activities are structured. They don't hang around on a green with people, and so they only know people on Facebook. And so they would say, you know, this guy will comment on my pictures on Facebook, but if he saw me in the street, he'd cross the road. It's a different type of connection is formed, and that kind of our virtual connections does have an impact on our intimacy and development of a capacity to be able to socialize, be comfortable amongst kind of mixed gendered company, that sort of stuff. And a lot of that, which was very healthy in my experience of adolescence, I'm not so sure children have that opportunity. Or
it's interesting, you wouldn't think of that. But to go back then to where it's the difference in parenting now and what parents do, presumably that in itself is creating additional problems with adults, with the parents as well as the children, because there's that guilty feeling that you're not spending the time with the kids and that you're constantly rowing. And have you found that adults are developing more problems in recent years than...
Well, certainly, if you look at the parenting book market, there's never been more books telling you how to do it or telling you how you're doing it wrong. And as a parent who's kind of well-read or overly informed, that can make you feel incredibly anxious. And I suppose, like, the guilt in having a child who's not performing the way that you would. And, like, my experience of that would have been, we had a colicky child. Our first kid had colic for 12 weeks. And being a new parent, it was... we were sure we were doing something wrong. You know, what is, you know, why is he so unhappy?
Did you have your mum or your wife's mum there?
Because I did.
Wasn't that always a stabilising factor?
That was huge, because anyone else who came to visit was gone in 2 minutes because he was roaring for the whole time. But from the point of view, like, there was no book that told you how to cope with driving up and down the Nace Road at 4 a.m. in the morning trying to get him to sleep. You know what I mean? But I always remember thinking, this is something where it's something wrong with the feed, we're giving him something wrong. Whereas other people who were more kind of accustomed to that were kind of saying, this will pass, 12 weeks you won't know, and lo and behold it did. But I think there is that natural assumption that we assume that we're doing something wrong, or how do we get it right? And again, that feeds back to what we were talking about last week about anxiety. And the anxiety drives consumerism in some respects. If you don't have this, then you're at a loss. And if you look at how things are marketed to parents and children about, you must have this product or else you're doomed. I don't know whether children or adults have a kind of a well-informed media literacy around that, or kind of can combat that. It can be quite overwhelming.
Well, it's brainwashing. I mean, if you look at the advertising, the whole thing, I mean, and in the olden days when they had subliminal advertising, which they banned, but it is brainwashing, isn't it?
Oh, completely. And again, you have so many digital media that are now feeding us with advertising, and the way in which, you know, media can kind of absorb what we search and then, you know, provide us with the information. This kind of illusion that, you know, the internet has broadened our horizons, that we can look up anything now. In actual fact, Google sorts out what you see when you do a search, because it gives you the stuff that you've searched before. So it may indeed not be opening our minds, but rather narrowing in what we see in that respect.
Okay,
do you know? So, you know, these are things that are kind of formulaically decided upon. But getting back to the point around parents, I just think that the pressure for parents to get it right, and the time available for them to do that, is two ingredients that make for problematic kind of parenting self-assessment, I suppose.
Right. So, if you were to give a magic solution, quick magic solution for a parent, what would it be?
I think it's to have an open and honest relationship with your child, no matter what. And I would say this, you know, in terms of any circumstances, if your child can come to you when they're struggling and know that you've got it for them, and you don't have to have solutions. I would say to parents, the best approach you can have is, imagine you're sitting on a roller coaster and you're terrified and the child is terrified. You're in Disneyland or wherever it is, Wonderland. You'd put your arm around them saying, I don't know what's coming up here, but we'll do it together. And whatever happens, I'm here for you. Mm-hmm. And I think that message is all that you need to give.
That's a lovely
to a
message,
child.
Actually. You know, yeah.
It's not that I have the yeah. answers. Yeah, it's yeah. not that this is not going to be scary. Mm. It's not. I'm not paving a way, and I'm not going to take away all your distress. But when you're distressed, I'll be here with you.
Okay.
And I just think that for children, teenagers will always say to you, you know, my mom doesn't get it, but she tries. And that's... Yeah. As much as you can hope
yeah,
for.
Okay.
Because there is a kind of an idea that we need to be another friend or another peer with our teenagers. And teenagers oftentimes very much don't need another peer. They need a parent. And so, you know, that adopting that approach is different. It's not that you're trying to be cool and down with it. You're just going to be there for them. And
but time is also a problem, isn't it?
Time is huge. Time so is how, a huge problem.
How did you deal with the time issue when you obviously have a very busy life?
I try and protect the time that I have as carefully as I can. I mean, in terms of doing work like my PhD work or even when I was writing the book last year, none of that would have happened before 10 o'clock at night. I have the benefit of being slightly insomniac, so I do most of our work really late at night. So that doesn't tend to impact on the children, but certainly making time for them was really important, and not taking up things that would have conflicted with that. But I just think I also invest in trying to teach them to have time on their own. I think that's really important, because I think boredom and management of boredom is an underestimated skill. You know, I think, if you think about the smartphone being the kind of anti-boredom device, like when I was getting that 65 bus, I used to get off and make a, three rings on the public phone box to tell my mum I was there.
But
there was a 10-minute drive to collect me and a 10-minute drive back. But the amount of time sitting on the wall, just waiting and working out my next move or pondering or reflecting, we've become kind of very mindful. Mindfulness is kind of the order of the day in terms of treating mental distress. It's because we've become mindless in many respects that we don't have space to think and reflect. And I would take my children to mass, not from a spiritual piece, but actually that they learn to sit for somewhere for 40 minutes and not be entertained. And you know,
that's
again,
a terrible thing to say about the poor priest.
but
you want to take that back?
My children are 2, 4, and 6, so they're not going to really engage in the ceremony in the same way as we would. But but I think there is there's something in teaching children to be alone, to manage, to self-soothe, to entertain themselves, that will come back to help them to cope with adversity when it inevitably arises.
You mentioned about your book there, and it's it was published in 2015. It's called Cop On. I've heard that a lot of growing up.
An undervalued skill.
It's obviously been very successful. Maybe just tell the listeners a little bit about it, what motivated you to write it. And
I suppose I was critical of parenting books openly when I would have spoken about them, because I think they made people nervous and anxious, and wanted to write a book that was a little bit different to that. And I wanted to write it from an Irish perspective, because I think sometimes, some of the kind of more complex books tell you fill out sheets and stuff like that, it can be quite a daunting task. So it was trying to simplify something that I've been asked a lot, and it does center around technology, because I think that has become the biggest question that parents have in the last 10 years is, at what age do I give my child Snapchat, Facebook, whatever it might be? And my view has always been that age is arbitrary. It's the degree of cop on the child has. There are 12-year-olds out there who I would have no concerns with their online activity. If something inappropriate comes up, they'll red X out of it and that's it. There are 17-year-olds out there who would have grave concerns around what they do online. So it was to get away from using a kind of an age limit and trying to assess the cop on in your child, and how do we foster cop on in, and for me, cop on is just resilience. It's good decision making. It's a child who can react proportionately to the events in their lives. And how do we encourage that in young people, and how do we encourage it in children? And so there's some strategies around trying to manage their reactions to things and help parents to make child less anxious, to let them to find meaning in things that are important, and to avoid the seduction of technology, because I think parenting in a technological age has brought with it huge challenges.
I mean, we might talk about that a little later. Would you recommend the book for teenagers as much as adults.
Absolutely, right the way through. And it
was, so, and it's been written that way.
It's
that,
written in that way from the toddler.
I read a little bit, and it's very easy reading. Yeah. And it's, you know, anybody can understand it, which is great.
Yeah, and I think it's a book you'll probably dip into different aspects of it as your child gets older and as those challenges occur. I also wrote it because I would get contacted from people who are worried about something or would stress about something, and it's really one conversation is all that's needed in order for something to twig and for that to be different. It doesn't mean that you engage in this long protracted experience of therapy or things with your child. It might be just making you aware of something that might go different if you tried it. And, you know, simply, especially around younger children and older children, you know, trying to manage that. Sometimes it's a bit of simple advice rather than something terribly daunting. And I would always ask people to ask, you know, find out, is there a different way of doing this rather than trying to mull through it yourself? Sometimes a third eye can shed a bit of light on something that seems very dark when you're in it.
And it was interesting, I noticed on your website, which I think is a great attitude, you're not driving people from a therapy point of view to come and spend the next 5 years in therapy. As you said on the website, maybe one visit is enough, which is great, because there is this psychological fear, isn't it? There's something, oh, you know, I have to go for therapy. Oh, there's something definitely wrong with me. I'm in real trouble.
I think that's across the board in terms of how we experience our own mental lives. You know, this idea that going to therapy will mean we'll be diagnosed with something awful, or, you know, that we'll have to engage in it for a very long time. Oftentimes, and it's about life circumstances and stress that are creating a problem that seems kind of insurmountable at the time, and some advice or readjustment can make an awful difference, especially working with smaller children. You'd oftentimes see parents only, and you would never see that child, but you know, from hearing and from how things go, how to maybe change things a little bit at home can yield great results. I mean in terms of my therapeutic work is overwhelming in terms of I don't have time to keep up with the demand of that. And that was maybe another reason why I wrote the book, was to try and
get the message out
and, you know, and and doing shows like this is great, because you get an opportunity to speak to more people about how maybe think about something differently. And we've come a long way in this country around mental health and thinking about it differently, but I still think we've a long way to go. I still think it's something that people struggle with in terms of their own mental health and worry about finding out a problem if they go for help. That sometimes going for help will be unveiling more of a problem than you exist already. It's a bit like, you know, the anxious dad who doesn't want to go to the GP about that pain, because if they go, they're going to find out something awful.
That's more a men's thing, isn't it?
It tends to be.
Why? I've always been curious about that.
I think from the point of view of men, are the kind of macho kind of image is that, you know, you manage things by yourself. And it's only in dire circumstances will you ever ask for help. And that it comes down to the idea of the guy in the days before SatNav not asking for directions. Because
I'm not going to show myself up by not knowing.
The rolling down the windows is kind of admitting of defeat that you're lost. And you'd rather, you know, go around the roundabout 17 times rather than ask. And I think that's partly a male thing, but also partly an Irish thing. I think we do have an interesting culture in how we think about our lives, and
it's a whole other subject
for sure.
So you, I mean, for adults or for teenagers, where could they buy the book?
Oh, you can get the book in most good bookstores, Eason's, and all those sorts of places. You can get it on Amazon, and I think that there's e-books available. It's formerly Gillan Macmillan.
Yeah, on your website, can they?
There's a link there that they can go to well, through. Yeah. Okay.
One of the other things I read, and I was a bit concerned about, was your definition on your website, just a self-confessed technology addict. Have you gone to anyone about this?
No, I haven't. I suppose I love technology. Absolutely love it. And I'm intrigued by it. And I would be one of these kind of smart watch person, you know.
Have you got a smart watch?
I don't have it with me now. I do have one, yeah. My children won't think I have a technology obsession. They'll think I have an obsession with time. I noticed it in my own self. I noticed it, how it was creeping into my own life, and how it was interfering with my relationship with my children. And that was the kind of really important moment that I kind of said, this is not good, because I'd hear the stories.
I noticed you didn't mention your wife there. Is she a techno person as well? Is she pretty much into
it? No, my wife would spend a lot of time playing games on her phone.
Oh, does she?
Yeah, kind of Candy Crush stuff.
But we can deal with that later.
but I think from the point of view of, it was looking at technology as a whole in terms of how it was minimizing my children's opportunity to learn things. And I would say, you know, before, even when my little lad was small, if he said, "Dad, it was really good, can we go and get a game?" And as I was saying, you know, we'd go to Smith's and get it on Saturday. But between Tuesday or Saturday, you'd use that as leverage and say, "No, eat your dinner, you're not going to Smith's," or, you know, whatever, brush your teeth. Whereas now he was coming up to me saying, "Dad, can I have a game? I've been really good." And I say, "Yes." And he said, "Just put the password in and press install." So it was almost like that opportunity was going. And one of the really defining moments was I would record something on TV for him to watch. And we'd normally record off kind of cable channels, where this time I'd recorded off RTE. And he ran into me and saying, "The TV's broken." And when I went in, he was watching an ad. And it was something I'd recorded off RTE, and he couldn't understand why there was an ad, and he was indignant about it. What's this 3 minutes of Mary Kennedy telling me about Nationwide or whatever it was? And I went, "This is not good. You know, he's becoming quite a diva around not learning to wait and not learning to manage his expectations." And so I just thought about that a lot more. And I remember, my daughter was born, I posted a picture of her on Facebook when, like, baby Layla born, £7.2, all mother and baby well. And for 3 days I found myself going back in, refreshing the likes, refreshing the validation, and kind of thinking, you know, "Oh my God, this is really good." And 52 likes and 36 comments.
Somebody who's knows all of this.
Yeah, and I was saying to you last week, 7 years of personal therapy, and I was still found myself checking and checking and becoming kind of concerned. And then 2 days later, I remember thinking, you know, it plateaued out at about 76 likes and 56 comments, and I thought, you know, Facebook fame has arrived. But but then I realized that 126 friends. So I started going, hang on a second, there's 45 people think my child is ugly, and kind of going back and seeing that they I did completely, and I saw that people were on, they were, you know, checking in and Shannon's on the green, or they were, you know, drinking their Pinot Grigios, and I was going, they didn't like the picture. Why did they not like the picture? And kind of gotten consumed into that paranoid stage. And it was at that moment I just said to myself, "Coleman, cop on. You know, what are you doing here?" And then I said to myself, if I'm doing that as a person in their mid-30s who's been through all that personal therapy and adjustment and knows this, what's that like for a 14-year-old girl who's trying to find herself in this environment? And so it became a question that I asked young people about, and just uncovered a whole series of anxieties, stresses and worries that social media and technology were causing them, which made me put a mirror up, look at my own relationships, and see, how can I check this? How can I keep this in check? How can I get this better? And it happens so insidiously that you don't actually realize. You don't realize how dependent you become on something. And it's true, if you only find out you're an addict when you can't access what it is you desire. And so we don't leave our phones, don't leave our hands. So we don't really realize, many of us, just how dependent we are on them. You know, and the research and the studies into this would say, if you asked a crowd of people, I do parenting talks, and I'd ask people, many times do you think you check your phone a day? Mm. Most people will say 20, 30 maybe. The reality is probably more like 150 to 200, the research would suggest. That's an awful lot of time.
That's denial stuff, though.
Yeah, it's just lack of awareness. Yeah. It's as I say, it's kind of pumped through the vents into the Wi-Fi that we become. And, you know, even in our house, you know, our Wi-Fi went Christmas Eve last year and wasn't fixed till the guys came back in January. And you just realize, you know,
Christmas ruined.
No, it wasn't ruined. It probably made it better. But even things like my internet banking, I can't check watch something on Netflix and stuff. It's almost like, you know, I was asked once, do we think there'll be a revolution where people will say, I'm putting down my phones and my devices and going back? And I was saying, no, I think we're already hooked.
Well, look,
I think
it would be too difficult to give up cigarettes and drink and stuff like that. I'm just very conscious of the time. Again, we're just sort of flying through. So what bit of advice would you give people about that dependency in technology for young people and adults?
Yeah, adults as well. Again, I would have said, well, 5 years ago when we talked about it, it was always the teenagers and their devices, that's the problem. Now I speak to teenagers and they say, I can't get access my mom. because she's stuck in the device. I can't access my dad because he's stuck in the device. So it has, you know, the biggest migration of people are people in their late 30s, early 40s onto Facebook in the last 5 years, not teenagers. So it's flipped around a little bit, and now we actually have to think about it ourselves. But as a piece of advice, I think we need to see it as the snack food of a diet. And social communication through social media is like, it's like your McDonald's or your treat. We teach children how to moderate and proportion that as they get older. So you have your meat and two veg, and then you have a treat. It's no different with digital technology. If we don't have the meat and two veg of face-to-face communication, then we shouldn't be, you know, snacking on all this sort of stuff all the time. Yes, and people say, well, being on social media makes me feel less lonely. I'd say, well, a packet of potato makes you feel less hungry, but it doesn't make it nurturing and real and better. And I worry about, I suppose, young people who create relationships which are based on that, the sugary fix, rather than the authentic face-to-face intimacy, which in a sense will protect their mental lives as they get older.
Just very briefly, for about a minute and a half, about teenage sexuality. Is this becoming a big problem? Is it? Do I just regret that it didn't happen when I was younger?
No, well, sexualization is different than sexuality. Sexualization is the idea that children are becoming kind of pornified, if that makes sense, because pornography is becoming more part of our discourse. And, you know, it's not just down to pornography. There's, you know, music videos, the censorship around what children are exposed to is much, much greater. So the innocence of childhood is shrinking, and children are becoming, are having to imitate or act in a way that before they didn't have to. And that comes with it a lot of pressures and difficulties. However, again, I would say the actual real life relationships, you know, there's recent research that would say that kind of millennials are having less sex now than perhaps they would have done before. Mm-hmm. And that's the emergence of virtual relationships. And in other countries across the world, we see people engaging in more virtual relationships than real life relationships.
Japan,
because again, because that offers you a degree of control that real life relationships don't, you know. And we're becoming intolerant of the messiness of relationships. We don't want to hear the kerfuffle of stuff. So I'll just text you, you know, meet you tomorrow, 3:30, New Lancer K, and that'll be it, rather than having to listen to how your day was. So, you know, in terms of in relationships, we're becoming less interested in the work of relationships and what we can get out of it. Yeah. But I would say sexuality and sexualization is causing children to be more anxious than it is to become more promiscuous, if that makes sense.
Coleman, it's just again, the time has flown. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you.
If people, what's your website, and do you have a Twitter?
Twitter's at ColeNock77. That's probably the best way to get me, to be honest. And the website's just ColeManOctor.com. But Twitter is probably the best way to catch
me. Listen, fascinating insight. Lovely talking to you. From me, Richard Mulcahy, Curiosity Radio. Thank you to Karen on Sound. Mediascope following up next.